Okay, so we're back in Edson, part four, the final.
The home stretch.
The home stretch. And I really seriously did miss your introduction. One of the secrets to multitasking is tuning out. And I know that's bad, but...
Well, like I said earlier, or we discussed before lunch here, I think what I wanted you to explore was sort of the pedagogical background and support of the use of the tools that we've examined here in the last day and a half,
yeah,
as well as taking a look at maybe pursuing thoughts that would help us to design maybe a blended synchronous, asynchronous model for,
sure,
for delivery.
Well, and where I'm going to go with this, all right, I can't use the home button there because it's not my home. What I want to do, and John has seen some of this stuff, so... But he says he didn't understand it the last time he saw it. So we'll try it again. I'm going to pop in here. I just need to find it. Actually, it'd probably be... Nah, it'd be easier to use Google. And I had these slides loaded on this computer, and then I took them off. And so what I'm looking for here... Where did they go? That's not it. That's a good one, though. There we go. Is that it? Yeah. I think it's... Oh, that's... Well... Somebody out there has collected a bunch of my slides, so it's sort of like their little personal page. Here we go. This is the one I wanted. So, for those of you who are listening online, downs.ca/files/edmonton.ppt. And that'll give you the slides for this little bit. This is how, I'm not going to go through all of these slides because a lot of this stuff we've already covered. But I want to talk sort of the way I began introducing a lot of this Web 2.0 stuff to the group that was at NAICS. And it was because of that talk that John and others wanted me to come out here. So it seems right and reasonable to give you a taste of that. And this is the beginning of the background to some of the pedagogy. At some point along here, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and move from that background more to the concept of connectivism and learning networks specifically. So, I'm going to take it from there. So, you're getting old material, but it's not that old, actually. And just as an aside, too, this is an approach that has resonated where I've done it elsewhere. I've talked about this as well in places like Gander and North Bay and Summerside. And when I say these sorts of things to people who are educators, they're coming back to me and saying, yeah, that's been our experience, too. So I feel good about the validity of a lot of this stuff. And a lot of this stuff is stuff that if you've been looking at e-learning journals or magazines or things like that, you're beginning to see hints of already. And just even right off the bat, the first slide here is the millennials and the new net generation. And we've talked a bit about that. How many of you have been exposed to discussions of this in other forums? Yeah, a few? Is this new for most of you? Wow. Okay. Well, this is great. Well, no, it's not great. Never mind. The problem with multitasking is part of your brain goes this way, part of your brain goes that way, and sometimes you forget to switch part of it on. There's been a lot of research out there And I've linked to a couple of articles that are representative, and there are more things on my website and more if you searched on Google, about the changing nature of learners that have grown up with internet technology. And there are some researchers who are saying that their brains are actually, in certain senses, different than our own. If you agree, most cognitive theorists agree, that neural networks are plastic, that is, the structure of your brain alters depending on the experiences that you have, then because people have grown up in this multitasking, electronic communications kind of world, their brains have developed differently. Now, whether or not you buy into that, it is nonetheless true that there are observable, measurable differences in the ways that young people approach things like knowledge, media, communications, and learning. And people like Don Tapscott a bit, Mark Prensky is another, have been looking at this. This EDUCAUSE article here is a pretty good summary. That's by Diana Oblinger, who works with Microsoft. She's basically their top e-learning person at Microsoft, summarizing some of these things. The people who've grown up in this world simply assume that it's there. They assume that they're always connected to their friends. They assume that there will be information when and where they need it. They think it is odd and unusual if you require them to fill out forms on paper. And they sort of look at that and say, well, why would you do that? You can't search it. Things like that. They expect there to be a technological solution, a digital copy, that kind of support. And as they work with this, they as it says on the slide here, they multitask. And they quite literally multitask. They don't multitask in that bad blockout gourd version that I do. It's very common. You'll see them, you know, the TV will be on, they'll be chatting with their friend on their cell phone, they'll be IMing on their computer, they'll be doing all of this at once. And somebody was talking, you know, well, your IQ point drops 10 points when you multitask. That may be true, but if you think about it, if you have a person with a 120 IQ doing one thing...
Yeah, those
ones
with 80, it's an issue.
for those who have 80, it's an issue. But if you have a 120, you can drop to 110, but you're doing four things. So really, you're at 440. The point is, they will multitask. And, I'm looking here at a group of people who are pretty much immersed in technology. And, you know, you guys are multitasking like crazy. And maybe you don't realize that you're doing it. You're faking paying attention. But I know. but the thing is, the difference is in the reaction to it, right? If I'm from the world where you can only be doing one thing and I look at you and you're not obviously listening to me, I'm going to think, this person is zoned out, they're off doing something else, nothing's happening here, and I'm going to bring them back, you know, turn off their cell phone, turn off their pager, or as they did when I was in school, sit down, fold your hands, and try, with this group and with the people in the other sites who I can sometimes see talking and laughing and making balloon animals, it's okay because I know that you work in this environment, you've had a certain amount of exposure to this stuff, and therefore your brains have begun to warp or change. And so I know that you can be participating at your 110 level in this seminar, and that's fine. Twitch speed. Instant responses. They expect instant responses. I remember when email came out, and they're giving guides to companies on how to use email. It's, you know, promise to return their email in 4 working days. If you offer that level of service to somebody who's grown up with this technology, if you don't answer their email in 4 days, by day 3 they're checking the funeral notices. Because something is obviously wrong. And if they're contacting you by some of the newer technologies, instant messaging or Skype or something like that, if you don't come back within a few seconds, either you hate them, or you know, there's something wrong with your software or something like that. The communication really is instantaneous. It's the sort of thing, I'm doing a seminar, I've got the audio, I'll have the audio up, well, I promised it for last evening, for yesterday. There are people out there now wondering, what went wrong? How come it wasn't up? He said it would be up. And so tonight I'll actually linger a little bit after the session and make sure I can upload it, so it will be up for tonight. And it's that sort of responsiveness that's expected. And what this does, and we're going to see this in some of the other slides, is a lot of the overhead, a lot of the processes, a lot of the management that we use to control flows of information, flows of knowledge, processes, become less relevant. Now, I put their institutions irrelevant, which sounds like, oh my, it's anarchy. But what's happening is that instead of relying on institutions to do things for them, they're doing it themselves, which is actually a good thing. You may recall, I think it was about 2 years ago, there was a survey, might have been 3 years ago, a survey done just before Canada, a big, wide survey published in the Globe and Mail. It was about a 10-part article. And what it looked at was the changing attitudes of youth and culture. I linked to it in an article on my website titled My Canada. I'm not going to drop the slides to link to it, but it's there. And because in Canada, we're faced with, and you've all seen this, the declining participation in the political process, especially among youth, right? Youth votership is going down. If you look at media, newspapers, newspaper readership is dropping, and where it's dropping most dramatically is in the 18 to 24, the youth demographic, where it's something like 15% now. It's ridiculous. Newspapers, if those trends continue, there will be no newspapers because nobody's reading them. But what's happening, and that same article pointed out, that these people, they're withdrawing from the political process, but you also see an increase in this demographic in community activism, community involvement. At the same time that Globe and Mail article came out, there was an article in our local paper about some youth in Sackville, which is just down the road, who, for their summer project, organized community gardens in Sackville. And they did it completely outside the political process. They liaised a little bit because they needed land, and I don't know if you need gardening permits or whatever. But basically, they did it themselves. And we're seeing that. If you look in media, people are replacing traditional media with their own media. And that's what I mean by the institutions becoming irrelevant. In my own perception, this is my own take on this, what's happening is that with increased capacity is coming increased empowerment. Because they are able to do more, they do in fact do more. People were talking, what was the example that was used in conversation, the Brighton riots. And what's happening there is that the communications networks are beginning to underlie and make these things possible. You've heard about the Seattle riots. The Seattle riots were driven largely by instant messaging and things like that. In Australia, they had this rampage on the beach at Cronulla, and what happened there, again, was the result of communications. Now, of course, these are not good things. These are bad things. People shouldn't be out there rioting in the streets. But the thing is, they are able to self-organize in that way, and that is exactly what they are doing, and we need to be aware of that. And that's what makes the institutions that do the organizing for them less relevant in their lives. And this is important for all of you, because the schools are one of those major institutions that does the organizing for them. And so as time goes by in their lives, school becomes less relevant. And if you think about it from a pragmatic point of view, school is less relevant than Second Life, which is an online video game. School is less relevant than their blog role, which is their friends, or their network on Facebook. And again, we were talking a little bit before, where somebody who's in one of these things, like Second Life or whatever, their virtual world is more real than their real world. And their virtual world is what makes things happen in their lives. We're also seeing trends in the areas of business, industry, commerce, and enterprise. A lot of that was captured in a book. It was first a web, well, it was a manifesto to begin with, which sort of grew into a website. That came out actually in 1999, and it's of personal importance to me because I'm one of the original signatories of this manifesto, so I feel very proud, and I'll pat myself on the back. It's called the Clue Train Manifesto. And the first sentence of the Clue Train Manifesto is something like, markets are conversations. And as you go through the Clue Train Manifesto, what you're getting the sense of is that people more and more are wanting to take a hand in the direct creation of products and services instead of having something delivered to them, pre-assembled, you will use this, this color is black, that's your color. They want to have a role in that production. They want to have a conversation with the manufacturer. They want to break down that wall between client and server. And this has profound implications, of course, in business and in marketing, where marketing and product and good manufacturer was, you know, we'll build it and then you consume it. And this whole consumer thing is breaking down. The term that's used these days is prosumer, which is a combination of producer-consumer. And you see this reflected in Web 2.0 that we've talked about so far, right? The web has shifted from something that you consume to now something that you're much more active in producing. And the sheer numbers of the sites that we've seen, the blogs that we've seen, the social networks that we've seen, is evidence that people are taking a much more active hand in the production of the things that they consume. And this manifests itself in a wide variety of ways. I mean, it's not just, you know, them sending in, you know, here are my measurements, I want you to make pants for me at that measurement. That's the Alvin Toffler picture that he came up with in the third wave and all of that. We have a little bit of that. But, you know, things like environmental activism, right? These are my pants. They will come from environmentally friendly cotton. Or, you know, my tuna will not involve dolphins. Things. All of this is the consumer wanting to be involved in the production of the product. That's also what explains the success of chains such as The Body Shop, which is very sensitive to this, or Costco. A lot of people go to Costco not because of its prices, but because of its labor practices. Things like that. There's much more involvement in the production. That means companies, in order to accommodate this new desire, and not just company, but it also means school divisions, schools, and teachers, have to bring down that cloak, that barrier, have to begin to think about and acting on the idea of working more out into the open. And I know that this is something you've probably felt here in this school division more and more, as people want to become, parents and students want to become more and more involved in the process of delivering an education. And you're sitting there nodding, John.
Parents.
parents.
Exactly, versus our generation.
Absolutely. Parents want to be involved in the production. In the United States, we see this manifesting itself in things like homeschooling. There's something like 1 million people being homeschooled in the United States right now, which is just staggering when you think about it, and chartered schools. And again, all of these things where the consumers are taking an active hand in the production of what they're receiving. In our world, this is reflecting itself in some clear trends, and I sort of hinted at the trends in our discussions earlier, and then waited for the shouts to die down before I moved on. The trends, and I'm going to say that these are trends and these are not necessarily endpoints, because I certainly recognize the discussion that takes place about a need for balance, and I certainly recognize the system values or the social values or in the corporate workspace, the corporate values that will inform the direction of learning and education. Nonetheless, what people are looking for more and more is autonomy and choice. And that is especially the case in the more adult learners, but is increasingly the case in the lower level learners. And you see this maybe not so much in school, but you look at what people are doing outside of school, particularly with this internet technology. They're learning like crazy. The technology side over here, John, you asked them how they learned, and the response was, well, there's an awful lot of learning that gets done at home. And what's happening is that starts these days, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, they're online, they're learning. They're beginning to learn things at home, and then, they might be rewriting the home network so that the filtering systems are superseded, it's not much for a 12-year-old to hack a little PHP and write a site reflector. But the thing is, that's what they're doing. Active learning. They are much more inclined to learn by doing. We grew up, and I say we because although I didn't pay attention, I was still part of it, grew up learning by listening, learning by being shown. Right, you go to a classroom, the teacher will give you a lecture. This is what you do. Look at this group even. You guys expect to have your hands on. You've all got your computers on. Sometimes you're following the websites that I'm doing. Sometimes you're doing something else. And sometimes you're not even on the web. You're on Telnet. And that's a much more active kind of learning. You expect, and increasingly students expect, to learn by doing. Look at how, you want to see this. Get a new piece of software, still shrink-wrapped, hand the box to the student, doesn't really matter what age anymore these days, and watch what they do with it. Well, they'll get rid of the shrink-wrap, of course, they'll ignore the license, they'll pop the disk out, and put the box and everything aside, pop the disk into the machine and see what happens. And if it breaks, they might think of reading the manual. Maybe, but probably not. And they just simply expect to learn how this thing works by working with it. Now, this is something game designers know very well, and there are sites out there, some very good sites on theory of game design and things like that, and gaming and learning, people like James Paul G and Seymour Papert will talk about games, the way games will step people through learning how to do it, and there's a whole process that I won't get into, but the idea is that the game challenges you, makes you do something over and over until it becomes a habit, and then breaks whatever rule that you've learned in order to take you to the next level, and then you just level up all the way through. And the other side of it is too is you can try different things, and it's a low-risk sort of thing. Remember I was talking about that with the templates on Blogger, where the question was, can people do these templates themselves? And of course, yes, because you go in, you make some changes, and it either works or it doesn't. If you completely blew up your template, no problem, you just reload the original template and start over. So, and that's how they learn CSS. They do it until it blows up, they start over. They do it until it blows up, they start over. And that's how they learn. You couldn't possibly teach, well, you could, but you really shouldn't. I would never dream of teaching CSS by getting up in front of a room and saying, okay, here's the first CSS element, color, and then they would never learn it that way. Well, they might. I mean, people are adaptable. But, and if you think about this now, we've had the autonomy, we have the active learning, we're seeing more of an interdependence and almost an exchange of roles between teacher and student. When I talked about professional development involving co-learning, teacher and student, remember I mentioned that with respect to podcasting? This is the sort of thing that I was thinking about, where the teacher and the student almost begin to assume the same role in certain circumstances. And it has to be that way in an age where, you know, the entire internet might be different next week. And the teacher and the student very much do have to co-learn. And in my experience, what this is the teaching, instead of being a showing, becomes a modeling sort of thing. You show your students how to learn by engaging in the process of learning right beside them. Connectivism is a word coined by George Siemens, which I think is inherently unfair, because I should have come up with it. It's actually a combination of two words, connectivism, which is actually derived from computer science and artificial intelligence. Connectivism is a neural network type of artificial intelligence. And constructivism, which is a major pedagogical theory, which many of you will have heard of because you're teachers, many of you, in which learning is an active process whereby the student constructs meaning, constructs knowledge for themselves, rather than having it delivered to them. Now, you take these two concepts and you merge them together, you get something like connectivism. And there's a bunch of stuff that's going on here. And George takes a slightly different approach to it than I do, but we're talking similar things. And one of the major thing here in connectivism is that our idea of knowledge residing in a single place is importantly false. That knowledge isn't like a bottle of water that you can just move around. Knowledge is actually distributed across a group of people. And what you learn and the way you learn is to place yourself into a network, typically a network of people, but it can also include a network of resources. And then knowing and learning basically involve working that network. Now that might seem odd and unusual because, you know, really you just learn by reading a book, right? But no. In the connectivism, the process could involve a book, but you can't say you've learned that book until you have engaged with other people in some way related to the knowledge that you've gained from that book. That was badly expressed. I admit it. How do I want to put this? I mean, if you go, remember I was talking about the municipal administrators in Alberta, right? And these are very competent people. They run towns, they're town managers, they're elected officials and all of that. And they have a base of knowledge. And when people come to their office, they will say, you know, this town manager knows such and such. But that knowledge consists in their being able to pick up the phone and call somebody else for that piece of information. The knowledge does not necessarily reside in their head. The important thing is that because they are part of this network, they have the capacity to acquire and use this knowledge very quickly. But it's a bit more than that. Thomas Kuhn wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And what that book talks about is the way science changes over time. Now if you think about it, think back 1,000 years ago, they thought the Earth was flat, they didn't know about oxygen, all of that. Our natural inclination is to say, well, these people were really stupid. But they weren't stupid. It's just they saw the world in a different way. And knowing about the world isn't just knowing a set of facts, but it's being immersed or embedded in a world view. And this world view is contained not just in one person's mind, but in a society. It's social knowledge. The world is flat, not simply because I think it's flat, but everyone thinks it's flat. What else would it be? And I look at it, and it's just social knowledge. And so to Kuhn, being a scientist is being embedded, being immersed in this community of learners. And one of his famous lines, and this may resonate with you, is learning science isn't learning about formulas or things like that. Learning science is learning how to do the problems at the end of the chapter. And those of you who have taken science will know that, and this is why I ended up in philosophy, the problems at the end of the chapter contain stuff that wasn't in the chapter. I hated that. I hated that with a passion, but the thing is, what they're trying to do there, and I was always explaining, well, we're just trying to get you to move up, right? But they're forcing you to adopt this world view so that you'll have just this automatic, oh yeah, of course you would do, of course you would apply. In mathematics, it was always substitutivity, right? And they wanted you to internalize substitutivity. I never did. I couldn't do it. I just, you have something this long and it's X. There's no way. You can't. I just didn't have the cognitive capacity to believe that you could pull that off. And so I struggled in math. And it's funny because it wasn't like I'm not smart enough. It was that I just couldn't wrap my brain around that way of viewing the world. You cannot take a long, complex formula and represent it with X. It's just wrong to me. And it was in my master's in philosophy of mathematics with a professor called Verena Huber Dyson that I finally got my, well, I won't say revenge, that's the wrong word, but she was doing some extensive work in philosophy of mathematics, including skepticism about the principle of substitutivity. And I thought, I'm home. but it's that sort of thing. And so if learning is basically being immersed in a worldview, if meaning is distributed across a web or a network of people and resources, what does that mean to learning? I think that's not where I wanted to go. Okay, that changes the approach that we have to learning new things. It changes the approach that we have to teaching, because now we have to think of teaching not in the old information transmission mode, and even some of the new theories like constructivism or active learning, and that you look at them, you look at Moore, or you look at I can't remember his name, but he's at Utah. I always forget his name. Never mind. But anyhow, you look at these theories, and they're still talking about transmission of information, and Moore talks about transactional distance. And that's where you get the whole interactivity and feedback thing. But it's like sending a signal, and when you have interaction, it's me being a technologist, I thought, oh yeah, like checksum, where you're verifying that the information was transmitted. But it's not like that anymore, because it's not a process of transmitting information anymore, because there's no information to transmit. It's rather a process of having people adopt a worldview, putting people into an environment. And that's why I lean toward the sorts of technologies that I've been talking about. If you think about blogs, and if you think about social networks, social bookmarking, podcasting, and all of that, what we are essentially doing is finding different ways of immersing people into online communities. And there's been a lot of work done on online communities and online learning communities. Etienne Wenger is somebody who's very well known in this subject, who's done a lot of work in this area. And the idea here is that through immersion, you become knowledgeable. Through immersion and practice and working within this community, where this community reflects your own interests. And that's how we see, we go back to the beginning, the new kind of engagement in community that we're seeing, where now we're not being delivered to by our politicians and all of that, but we're engaging in the community and becoming the community ourselves. That's basically the message that I want to give at this point, so I don't want to take that too much further because, well, I can't remember it. No, I'm just kidding. But I just wanted to sketch that approach to learning, and maybe I'll stop here and see what your reactions to it are. Are you seeing this in your own life? Are you seeing this in your students? Are they learning through transmission, or are they learning through engagement?
Engagement more than anything. They resist being told. They really enjoy finding out.
How are we teaching them?
Engagement.
I think it's a challenge we've got this with our assessment methods, right? As we might know, the problem is we're trying to juggle lots of balls, and the assessment ball is not structured around, in my opinion, engagement. It's structured more around
transmission
of bodies of knowledge.
Right.
So,
but
the bottom line is that's how we're assessed as an organisation. So it's kind of like, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing or whatever, it's at the, certainly at the high school level, it's not going to change. Regardless of whether it's a good fit with the way the kids learn or not, it won't change until the assessment structure changes, or until organisations are no longer judged by the assessment structure.
Because funding assessment knows that you're all tied together, right?
Well,
you get your credit units based on how many people you can get through a thing that can be assessed quickly and easily, so the school can get that much more money.
But, you know, even like parents and communities assessment of a good school or a bad school,
right?
You know, like who's that?
Fraser Institute,
all that kind of stuff. Like, I agree with you, I think it has changed, and I think that we could get a lot better results by, like, responding to the way that we know kids learn. I think the problem is that as professionals, we might have an opinion, we might think about these things, but as I just talked about, how do you quantify that? Mm-hmm. How do you quantify your gut reaction that has changed? You know what I mean?
Sure.
How do you know you're right? And there's guys like Hofstede's work and stuff, like you can, there is social scientists out there, there are measures or other structures that you can imitate or be guided by. But I think it's really interesting to look at cultural differences between generations, just as we've often looked at cultural differences between countries.
Sure.
But even the culture that we're stuck in, where I look back even further, and you're going, okay, so we do all these things and I believe all this stuff, but ultimately, There's talk from Alberta that they'll fund schools according to the way you perform on your provincial achievement tests and your grade 12 exams. And that's where it'll come from. And we want to do more of a for these kids, a constructivist approach. You still have to do that in the time and the fashion that makes it feasible so that you're not in my 5-year growth period, my school doesn't suddenly have no money.
And also going back to our earlier discussion, the bottom line is we do have a boss, right? And it is ultimately, I guess, the Minister for Education who pays our wages. So whether we believe it's a good idea or not,
you don't agree with
it. It is his call at the end of the day.
But they're making change on assessment too. The model for PATs now is a 40-60 split, 40 knowledge, 60 skill, and the definition of knowledge versus skills change.
Right.
So the skills now are applications of knowledge for creation or for other areas on top of those modified taxonomy. But it's not the same as it was last year. When a skill would might be a graphic. No, a graphic now is knowledge. They're going to give you information. So we're not teaching in that matter where they're being engaged. Filling the full knowledge, those results are going to be dropped off first. Because if they can't take that knowledge and apply it, they'd be better served through engagement in the situation.
So change is happening.
Change is happening.
The thing is, when you engage kids, that they actually figure out how it works. But when you assess them, it's not through engagement.
Yeah.
Because you can't.
Well, but more so it's going on. The question is, you're being designed where,
yes,
it's not based on knowledge at all. Sometimes, but you have to take that knowledge and take that over. Just knowing the knowledge isn't going to get there. You have to have those other skills.
I'd be in trouble then, because now the questions are like the problems at the end of the chapter. So,
I don't know whether it's the same. I assume it's probably the same in North America, like the gap between high school success being a poor predictor of university success historically. And that's linked to assessment too, because arguably, you could argue that to do good in high school, you need to sit down, shut up, do what you're told.
Right.
And then you'll be, comb your hair nice and stuff. And you'll be told in practice, right? And whereas, then you get to university, so you get all these kids who do great, to grade 12, and then they go off, to university, and all of a sudden people want to think independently and stuff, and that wasn't in the chapter.
Right. Exactly.
And they're not coming from that environment, so it's kind of ironic that how valid are our assessments anyway?
Right.
And even so, you take the next step further, okay, how does, a first degree predict your success in your career, or I bet there's probably the odd people that are highly successful in the first degree, they go on to do PhDs. Probably not. It's probably the average people who go on. You know what I mean? I know we do assessment, they say, what do you do? You have to have it, but it's how do you ever get truly valid assessment?
Well, I've thought about this. Most people don't like the answer I came up with. But it is quantifiable. I can give you numbers at the end of the process, but the method of assessment is something like this. The students are evaluated by their peers based on no criteria in a capricious and random fashion. And people ask, why would you come up with that? And my response is, because that's how it works in the rest of life.
Yeah. Well, that's very true.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it is quantifiable. It's interesting, it's who's faced with a big problem of assessment is Google. And how does Google know what the best site in the world is? You can't give sites a test because, they're inanimate objects that don't fill in the forms. But Google works very much on a recommendation-based system, which is kind of a modification of what I just proposed, isn't it? And it's a complex metric of, how many sites link to you, how important those sites are. And there's a whole field of study out there, excuse me, under the heading of recommender systems. And excuse me. You may have seen some of those. You go to a site and pick a piece of music to listen to, and the site says people who liked this piece of music also liked, and that's a recommender system. And the way the recommender systems work is they look at who you are, what are your demographics, and what do you like, and then they compare people like you who like the things that you like. Also like such and such, and they're able to narrow into something like that. And it seems to me more and more, just generically, that assessment professionally in the professional world is moving in that direction as well. Like, look at me. I'm technically completely unqualified to be doing this. I mean, I'm a philosopher. My degrees are in philosophy. I should be in a university office going, Right? I'm doing the tech stuff and all of that, and the social networking and the Perl hacking and all of that. And what comes, where that came from is my own learning and all of that, but where the assessment of my learning came from was the community. And the community as a whole, remember this knowledge is distributed, the community as a whole over time linked to or referred to or talked about the stuff that I did more and more to the point where I end up in a position like this, even though I'm completely unqualified. And so again, it's that sort of distributed assessment. Now, I know that this is completely different and not the same as knowing whether someone can do grade 12 math. But the question I ask is twofold. I mean, first of all, is it important whether or not we know that somebody can do grade 12 math? And secondly, is it important or is it appropriate to evaluate that based on test results or any sort of formal process as opposed to some sort of community evaluation? I mean, what would it be like if we took evaluation completely out of the hands of instructors and indeed even the school system and put it into the community? Can we even picture that?
But then the problem is, like, surely one of the reasons is for Bain to give people some kind of qualification so that they can move from one community to another, right? And then so they can move within their province or their country or the world, right? And people can recognize where they are or whatever or what they can and can't do.
Right.
So
but that's not a problem anymore because everything's online.
Oh, I know.
But, but by the same token, what you're suggesting is to bring it back more to a community-oriented, I would go back to the tribal learnings. So what did I learn? I learned what the guys in the community taught me, and it was good for that community. It doesn't get me anywhere else in the world. If there is no commonly defined set of parameters.
I think you'd be inhibited by, you'd be stuck in your own community.
Right.
And furthermore, with the creative kids that we've got, like, it'd be pretty easy to, arguably, to create enough pseudonyms to artificially inflate your whatever you mark or grade, how are you going to do it anyway? Because you could skew your own community.
Sure, you're talking about gaming the system and all of that. Well, that's where we come back to identity. A lot of this stuff comes back to identity. So, assume identity. I'm the thing is, what I'm trying to get at. Oh.
You asked if you could take math, grade 12 math, and have it assessed in the community. I think the simple answer to that is no. Math theory simply isn't applicable in the community. The average person doesn't know what's taught in math theory, how it's delivered, and what they need to assess. I think we have to stay where we are. How do you think it can be assessed and by peers, as you suggested before. Nobody in the working world is assessed by their peers. The teachers that I teach with, they don't tell me if I'm doing a good job or not. That's done by the administration. And when I was out and had a real job, that wasn't a teaching job. I was assessed by my managers. I don't think we can have peer assessment in our school system, and for sure it can't be done in the community.
It's funny that you, and I'm not surprised, I think you took the right argumentative move here, although it's not the one I would take, but because you moved it immediately into a hierarchical system, and you said nobody's assessed by their peers, they're assessed by their managers, and then I think about the way I relate with my managers, and if my managers don't treat me like a peer, then they lose me, because... And again, it's this personal empowerment thing, right? Where it's not a boss wage earner relationship anymore. It's a negotiation of mutual value, and so the manager just becomes one other person in my life that I negotiate mutual value with. You know, it's like the relation between me and John, right? John can't tell me what to do, and I can't tell him what to do, but I'm here doing what he wants me to do. How did that happen?
Get paid.
I'm not even getting paid for it. You know, and so it becomes like that. And the other thing too, and I think this is really relevant, is that when you have a structured system where managers tell staff what to do and assess and all of that, because of the rapidly changing environment that we're living in, and because of the increasingly specialized nature of the work that we do, the manager very often has no idea how to evaluate the performance of the employee. And so over time, the quality of these evaluations gets lower and lower. You know, and that's why we saw the spate of business books that came out in the 80s and 90s, like the Peter Principle and all of that, rising to your level of incompetence. And so it's becoming more the case that if we want an accurate assessment of the quality of the work that's done by somebody, the only way to do it is to have peers evaluate them. It may be the case now that we work in a hierarchical structured system, but it may be the case that in this information environment, that kind of system is inappropriate. And if you go back to Clue Train again, you'll find a lot about that sort of thing. Comments?
Sure.
Wolf Creek?
I think there's some knowledge bases that are absolute, where, like in mathematics, the fundamental mathematics, the laws of the theorems that go with mathematics is, it's knowledge, it's not necessarily opinion. That type of information can't be subjectively evaluated based on peers. You have to either know it or you don't know it. You're either correct or you're incorrect. That's the gist of math. Maybe in the social sciences you have more subjectivity and more leeway. But I don't understand I can see how in peer evaluation at the doctoral level, because that's the way the system there works. Because you are not evaluated based on peer evaluation, but for my kid, he either knows his addition and subtraction, or he doesn't know it. And if he gets to grade 12 and he doesn't know how to add or subtract, boy, I think that his peers would help fix that problem. But I don't know. I find it hard to imagine using peer evaluation for mathematics, but maybe in social sciences, maybe, but...
Well, okay, let me respond. What is the current population of El Paso?
Google it.
No, the point is, that is a fact, whatever it happens to be, and I don't know what it is, but it has a right and wrong answer, doesn't it? Right? The current population of El Paso is a known finite quantity about which you're either right or wrong. So, but your reaction when I asked you that is, who cares? Right? How is that relevant?
But Stephen, it seems to me that what would be evaluated based on that question isn't necessarily the actual population of El Paso, but the knowledge, skills, ability to find out what the population is. If somebody needs to know, then have we given our students the skill set and the understanding of Google or whatever else to actually find the answer, find the fact that's necessary. So I think really what Terry was talking about was how do we have these kids achieve the mathematical skills to be able to approach a mathematical problem.
Well, but if you're saying it that way, then if that's what we need, if it's how to find the answer, why not just give them all a calculator and say, good, done teaching math. Right? I mean, so, because that's not what we're after here. Right? We're after them having this certain piece of knowledge in their head. How to add two numbers. How to do differential calculus. Whatever. And the point that I'm getting at is that it's not that things have a definite right or wrong answer that's important here. It's that there are lots of things that have right and wrong answers, but the big important thing is picking out the right sort of things to be looking at, the right sort of things to be learning. We talk about grade 12 math, and the first comment that came back, well, you can't have the community evaluate grade 12 math because it's not used in the community. And I just sort of go, well, why are you teaching it? You know, I mean, of what value is it? And I know there's a story and there's an answer. I understand that. But it becomes to be the case, who makes that call? Who decides? And again, I know there is a process, but how embedded is that process into that hierarchical system that we just referred to? And are the people at the top of that decision-making process qualified to determine whether or not a grade 12 student needs to calculate sines without a calculator? And it's those sorts of questions that I'm after here. Because, you know, I mean, assessment of any sort presupposes a certain body of knowledge. A certain body of knowledge presupposes a certain world of view, a certain world view. Who picks the world view? And is it necessary that all people in a society have the same world view? Assessment presupposes a foundational base of knowledge. What makes a piece of knowledge foundational? What makes literacy foundational? If you ask Seymour Papert will say it's foundational because you can't do the stuff you really want to do without it. The foundationalism of a certain piece of knowledge comes up in the application. Now, well, if that's true, why are we telling people what to do? If they do what they want to do, and literacy really is foundational, the need for it will come up. So it's sort of turning this on its head. And I'm not expecting everybody to believe me and accept what I'm saying here, but I'm throwing this alternative interpretation of assessment and grading in order to push some of the assumptions that we have on it now, because it's these very assumptions that are being pushed by this technology.
Now, Stephen, what is then our role as educators in as we reality, the way that assessment is done now, but how would you propose here would play out in your model that you're talking about?
Well, okay, now assuming not the background that we have, right? Assuming we don't have standardized tests that force everybody to learn something. The sort of picture that I have in mind as educator is something like a combination of trusted friend, coach, and role model. The person to whom people turn to when they need help trying to do what they want to do and don't know what to do next. where the association between educator and student at whatever level is a voluntary association, a mutual engagement, where the educator expects to learn from the student at the time the student is learning from the educator. And so that sort of picture. I'll leave it there and see how that goes.
So are you proposing a whole new learning paradigm where everything we've learned for hundreds of years of education as a society is going to be thrown out, and we just say to the kids, well, what do you want to learn? Then come ask me for help.
Actually, I'm saying something even a little more radical than that. If you can believe it.
Yes.
What I'm saying is that this is in fact where we are headed now. That this is the trend, that our new tools, our new technologies, and our new social organizations, that is the direction in which we are being pulled now. So it's not, and this is why, to me, it doesn't matter so much whether or not you believe me, because from my perspective, this is going to happen anyways. It's just like me dealing with my supervisor, right? It doesn't matter whether my supervisor believes me about hierarchical systems or not, because he has to deal with me. And I don't believe in them, and he's stuck with that. And more and more people coming into the workplace are like that. Now, we're not seeing that in mass quantities right now. We're not seeing like all employees and all companies and that taking that sort of attitude, but we're seeing more and more take that attitude, where people are bypassing the traditional system.
I can see as adults, a worker coming up to his boss and saying, "Look, I'd like to be the manager of the Western Division. What do I need to do to get there?" As adults, we can do that, but how would a 6-year-old or a grade 6 student say, "I want to learn about this. Help me learn it"?
Yeah.
Like, at what point can you say you are now ready to make your own decisions on what to learn and how to learn?
Well, again, see, we're that question treats learning as organized by a set of subjects, and now it's like they're picking the subjects off a menu. And they might pick subjects badly, or they might not pick any subjects, and that's the sort of thing that comes up. But it's more the case that learning becomes something like, how do I want to phrase this? It's more like the 6-year-old does the sorts of things that 6-year-olds want to do, and in the environment that they're in, they're, if you will, gently encouraged or whatever to do them better. And that might even just be through interactions with their peers or whatever. But as they try to do the sorts of things they do, some of them model building, others skiing, others whatever, right? Different people have different aptitudes. I don't think you'll find any 6-year-old who will just sit there and twiddle their thumbs. They'll all do something, even if it's just ringing a bell randomly. And the learning comes in the use of the resources that are available to them in their environment, or to use the jargony word, the affordances of their environment. And these affordances, these opportunities in their environment, are learning opportunities. And what is driving the selection by the 6-year-old or by the adult isn't capricious choice, it's need. Right? They need this learning now in this context. Or they need this resource. Or they need the advice of this teacher or this mentor or this coach. And so the selection is drawn on an ad hoc basis depending on what they're doing. Now, I'm describing an end point here, and that this is an end point that might not be reached for 100 years or whatever, but you can almost picture that sort of process unfolding even now, where like in project-based learning, for example, where we introduce them to a project, they need to do some sort of project, but we do it in an environment where the resources they need to complete that project will be on hand. And so there's direction in the sense that, okay, we're assigning them a project. And you think of that as an intermediate stage, right? Where we assign them the project, but not the subjects they need to learn in order to complete the project. And you find that more and more in the applications that they use online. How do your students learn how to blog? They all learned how to blog before you guys ever did. But because they were in an environment where the things that they needed to learn how to blog were available to them in that environment. Video game, you look at the enormous amount of knowledge. I mean, kids know Middle Earth better than they know Earth. And they know it because they needed maps, they needed city demographics and all of that in order to level. And why did they level? Because they wanted to become a wizard. Why did they become a wizard? Because that's what their peer group does, that's what their peer group values. So, again, this game environment is an intermediate stage, right? It's it's not, if you're being put into a game, you're still sort of being directed, but if you imagine that sort of thing, but where the environment that they're in is not a game environment, but real life. Kid wants to manage the Western Division. Well, I don't know, because managers are up. But anyhow, kid wants to manage the Western Division. What does the kid do? Kid opens up the Western Division Manager's Environment Toolkit and starts managing. Now, whether or not the Western Division listens to what the kid says, different story, right? But the kid starts managing. Starts, manipulating purchases, staffing, whatever. Now, the Western Division isn't actually doing what the kid says, but that what the kid does say is available to the Western Division, and the kid knows it. So, think about this now. Kid is acting as a manager of the Western Division. Isn't really the manager, but the real manager of the Western Division has access to the kid's managing. That gives motivation to the kid, assuming the kid wants to be the manager of the Western Division. And over time, the kid wants to be a better manager. So over time, the kid starts reading, budget forecasts. Well, about a six-year-old can read a budget forecast. Well, probably none. But in the budget forecast is the learning that they need in order to learn how to learn budget forecasts. And so, it's a slow process. And their first budgets are really bad. And the managers don't listen to them because they were made by a six-year-old. But over time, if this is the sort of thing that interests this kid begins to get pretty good at doing budget forecasts. And all of a sudden, what the kid is doing in budget forecast begins to be reflected in the actual practice of the Western Division. Why? Well, because the kid's established a reputation. Budget forecasts are good. And if you imagine now, like, hundreds of kids doing that, and you can see how the Western Division could be managed entirely by people trying to become managers of the Western Division, simply by taking what they're doing in their Western Division management application. They learn by doing. They become engaged in actual society at a very young age. And actual society, when they're 6 years old, actual society doesn't really value their knowledge a whole lot because they're not very competent. But because they want to be valued by society, they have this motivation to do these things better. In managing the Western Division, or in being a professional skier, or in being a ballerina, or a philosopher, or even an accountant, who knows? So that's the picture. Now that's not something that's going to happen tomorrow. And quite honestly, that's not going to happen in the schools. It's going to happen outside the schools. And what I'm seeing here is this is now already happening outside the schools. And it's happening at a more adult level. Jay Cross, for example, who's a learning theorist based in Berkeley, California, who's very well known and respected. Watch for his new book that's coming out sometime this spring. He talks... nice. He talks about... 80% of all learning is informal learning, while at the same time we spend 80% of our resources on formal learning. I'm being blocked by the distance here. That's pretty funny. See, this is what I mean by back channel, eh? And as we look at kids using the internet today, and this has come up a few times already, they have a second life outside their school life, and their second life is a learning life. And because that second life is a learning life, as assessment of learning becomes less formal, and it will become less formal, as things like prior recognition or prior learning come into play, this second life more and more replaces their learning life. And you'll run into the problem in your schools that these people are learning their stuff on your time.
So how many kids in the Canadian context, given the reach of high-speed internet versus, say, west or east of here towards Edmonton, there's really no connectivity outside of 2880.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, the better the bandwidth, the better the computers, the more likely this is to penetrate that environment. And there's a direct correlation between connectivity and this self-learning and this sort of empowerment, which is why things like connectivity and things like even SuperNet matter so important.
See, Peter might have more of an issue with kids and the internet after school activity that I might have for 25% of our kids. Yeah, that's an inhibitor. Grab cash. There's a high penetration of internet to the homes. Jasper, too. What do you think, Peter?
We're listening to this, and of course, we're very, very interested. We here think that kids are different. And we do think that they're not as interested in knowing everything as long as they've got access to the information. And we do believe that they're learning a lot more outside of schools than they did in the past. And generally, we're more or less agreeing with what you're saying, Steve. Now, again, we're living in the context of a school division. And again, I'd be interested in what you think we as school divisions then should be doing in this reality. Or this
coming
reality, as you see.
Sure. And the answer, the stock cliche answer that I have is that more and more schools should integrate, if you will, life into learning. Okay, that's a bad cliche, but the idea is more and more to make learning experiences real world experiences. You know, students are interested in journalism. Get them doing real journalism. The students are interested in silviculture. Get them into a forest. You know, the students are interested in accounting. Turn over the school's books to them. A copy. you know what I mean? And I see signs of that all over, that is happening. I see it all over the place. And you go on the internet, you see lots of these real-world experiences. And indeed, blogging is one of those real-world experiences. They're writing not just for their teacher, they're writing for the world. And so that's what I recommend. In other words, try to make school as much like what they're doing outside of school as possible by making school relevant to their lives. And I know a lot of schools are doing it. And I know that this is happening more, and I know the constraints that are preventing schools from doing it. But I think that's the direction schools can best take to adapt to this environment.
That's assuming there's an environment that we want to support. Yeah. See, what we're talking about is like a significant cultural change. Like when we're talking about like people's interaction with their bosses and stuff before, we were talking over here about like if I'm a teacher in Japan and I'm very like dictatorial and I give them specific tasks to do and they never question everything, they might think I'm a great teacher. If I only teach like that, Jasper, and I never give the kids any free choice and never give them any flexibility,
right,
they're going to think I'm a terrible teacher.
Right.
Right? So the power-distance relationship is already different in different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're talking about is a phenomenon that may well change across the whole of the Western world, I guess.
Right? Yeah.
It's whether or not we think that's a good thing, whether we want to support that or not.
Well, I mean, that's a good point, but I mean, of course, I look at it from a different perspective. I mean, the way I hear that, from my worldview, if you will, is authority doesn't like to let go of authority. And so, you know, there will be some people who are going to resist this in order to maintain their authority, their power, and their control. Right? I mean, remember, this is how I'm hearing it. This is not necessarily how you're saying it. And, you know, to me, to my worldview, less authority is a good thing. I depend on that. But that doesn't necessarily make it a good thing. And then we talk to other people. I'm looking at two people in authority over here. And talking about social values, social needs, and all of that, and actually I'm very conscious of the need for that balance. Then, you know, you can come up with pretty good arguments that argue for authority in this thing, that thing, and the other thing. And now we're off into the balancing act, right? Now we're off into questions like who has authority, how is authority made, on what grounds is authority granted, what are the conditions under which authority interacts with autonomy, and those sorts of things. And even if you think authority is a good thing, I think that the game has changed enough now that authority is no longer a given. That, it used to be the boss was obeyed because the boss was the boss and he called the shots. And it always was. It was a he called the shots. And things are different now. And they're different now simply because we have more power. We can communicate with each other. It's the old saying, knowledge is power, information is power. That very fact changes the balance. And so it becomes a renegotiation process, and we're involved in that renegotiation process as a society, whether we like it or not. And that is happening. You talk about Japan. Japan's going through a horrible renegotiation process right now as we speak, with their changing modes of government and their redefinition of democracy in that country. And, you know, the radical things like cutting back the post office, which is the major government employer, and things like that. It's happening there. It's happening across the world at different levels and in different rates in different societies. But everywhere this thing touches, that social order changes. And so we need to, anyone who's in any position of authority is now in a position where automatically they now have to renegotiate the conditions of that authority, because the conditions that used to hold, that granted that authority, no longer hold. And there needs to be a balance between authority and autonomy, my view. Some people nod, and some people write "ha ha" on the screen.
I think the notion, though, of authority that you're talking about is formalized work structure type of authority, and I would view authority a little differently in that I think people earn or achieve authority through what value they add. So a less formalized type of authority. So if you think of it in those terms, I don't think that authority necessarily is bad. I think it's being authoritarian is really the bad notion here, that you're relying on a formal authority and you haven't established your own personal authority based on your skill set, your knowledge, your value add. So, maybe comment on that.
Sure. Well, I think that's exactly right. But my first reaction when you say that is, now we're right back to the system of assessment where you are being assessed by, if you will, your peers. I don't like using the word peers, but assessed by the community, right?
Yeah.
The authority derives. Go ahead.
But I think even that whole discussion around assessment is really a discussion around evaluation. When I mentioned assessment earlier in a focus within our school division, I wasn't talking about evaluation or provincial achievement tests or diploma exams. I think there are some very key issues there. I'm looking at, I mentioned the term assessment or learning, so we assess what we do on a constant, ongoing basis to see if we're actually achieving what we set out to do in terms of learning outcomes for kids. You know, are we prepping kids effectively for their future? And if not, what do we have to adjust? So we continually assess and adjust instruction accordingly. And I think that's kind of where some of the things you're talking about start to really address what Peter said. What is it that we need to do differently as school divisions to prep the millennials for their future? Because we do know that these kids do think that school is important, or at least according to the U.S. Department of Education, when they talk about the millennials, you know, they quote some stats based on some online survey, and it doesn't come to mind what it is, but it was a high percentage that felt doing well in school was important. Whether they thought school itself was important, they thought doing well was important, and going to college was important to their futures. But they're also a group of optimists about the future, maybe more optimistic than our generation.
Sure. I'd be optimistic too, actually. If I was like 15 years old and had the world at my fingertips like this, yeah, I'd be feeling pretty good too. I mean, we're not talking about two different things. I mean, we are talking about preparing people. We are talking about preparing ourselves. We are talking about acquiring skills and capacities. And where the difference in what I say and what is said isn't so extreme, just except in the manner in which it's organized and the manner in which it's managed. And it's interesting that if you simply suggest changing the management of something, it feels like now the whole house of cards is crumbling down because you've done that. It's funny, it just shows how that perception of organization is so embedded into our own worldviews. But I'm not trying to, you know, I mean, I'm not arguing to, you know, let's raise a nation of stupid people. Nobody's after that. But how we go about this, I think, is going to change and is changing. You know, and even the idea of assessments, and you know, I'm sitting here. As far as I'm concerned, I'm being assessed right now, and will continue to be assessed. And next week I'll be assessed. And I'll put this thing online, and other people that I don't know, total strangers, will assess it. And sometimes I'll get feedback, and sometimes I won't. And I'll listen to parts of it too, because I listen to my own talks, because I'm like that. And you know. That's how I stopped saying all the time, because I really got tired of it, listening to it, and I'll get feedback and I'll try to improve my own performance and all of that, and that's, to me, you know, a better way of assessing than a test. Can you imagine, you know, first of all, can you imagine getting me here to do a test on this stuff? This wouldn't happen. You'd have to pay me a lot of money. But even how could you have a test on this stuff? So, you know, and so I see it as being a looser, informal, more capricious, more anarchic, but because of this structure and not in spite of it, more accurate form of assessment. And the trick for us, and the reason why it's so hard to conceive of now, is the trick for us is to understand how to do this, because we don't know yet. We don't know how a community assesses an individual, how they assess that person's capacities, their outcomes, their skills. We don't have the metrics for it. We don't know how to quantify it and any of this stuff. But this is all going to come on stream because, you know, it's just technology. It really is. It's just technology. It's just figuring out how to observe and measure things. And these things are observable and measurable. Otherwise, he would have had no grounds for bringing me here. But he did. Whether they were good grounds or not, he'll hear. But you know, so it is obviously measurable. And it's just we need to learn how to do it. But now, we have the tools. Right, we can spot these connections. We can spot these influences. We can do something simple like count links, or we can do latent semantic analysis and find out, you know, in a letter written from you to your son 10 years from now. Oh, there's an idea. Jot them down. You know, I mean that kind of in-depth analysis is possible in the future. It's simply theory, and ironically, it's nothing more than mathematics. Grade 12. Never mind. how are we doing on time? Are we almost done?
It's about 2:30 at this point. And I think we promised the folks that we would sort of wrap up by about 3 o'clock here. I'm wondering at this point, maybe if we sort of step to the where do we go from here kind of an approach.
Sounds good.
Does that sound fair enough? I know that in the the discussions that have gone on in the last 2 days here, that there's been a lot of tools and a lot of processes thrown at us that I think we need to take some time and take home and think and sleep on and look at within the context of what we do within our everyday lives here. I'm wondering at this point, and I'll throw this out to the people here and the folks at Wolf Creek and at Black Bull. Is there a desire to continue exploring the ideas and the tools and whatnot that we've covered or been exposed to here, and what kind of mechanism should we do to do that?
Well, I'll jump into that one first, Gord. I think probably each organization is going to have to break away for a little bit and talk internally as to where the fits are and those kinds of things based on stages of program development. I know Peter and Gary and I have been exchanging emails in the background. That's another part of what goes on. And Peter's talking about some of the immediate applications because of the types of programs that they've already got running. And in discussion last night with Kurt and Ernie and James in particular here, that they felt that we probably need to get together after we've had time to noodle on this for a while as to whether there's an appropriate timeline where we should come back and say where's some fits. Because I think the conversation between Gary, Peter, and myself is that a lot of what we've looked at, especially from Peter's view, is a very direct fit to some of our ICT curriculum. And Kurt was kind of saying that too. The other side of this, are there a couple of nuggets out there that would have a value added to where we're at within our video conference, right? Strategies and the way in which we're building those types of programs. And I guess one of the questions that we had up front, based on what Stephen was going to present to us, are there areas that we can fit within our existing tool sets that we've invested in on some commercial products? And I guess that's a lot of sitting around and having some discussions. I know from a Grand Yellowhead perspective that we said that this was a user support year. That's why the techs are here with the teachers at the same time. That we have put money aside to be able to continue this, be it through an internal video conference set of events rather than this face-to-face thing. I think if we drop it right now, then I would immediately go, well, what was the point of all this? And I don't really want to see that we go there and then
can't just say, well, that was a fun 2 days in Edson. Yeah, the technology work, and geez, there's a lot of cool things out there, and then you go back to where we work, and then we don't revisit that. I think that would be the wrong thing to do. It would not fit at all within the division's in-service model. Right, if the philosophy gets the artificial insemination kind of model, and once then it's over, and goodbye. So from a yellowhead end of it, for those who want to work, I think we'll find the tag. But the question will be, is there a requirement, or how do we collaborate? I raised that question yesterday, Peter and Gary, and all the folks that are in NISCU and Pinoca. And I think it's going to take a little time. But let's pass that over to Peter for a second. There's a couple of comments.
John, obviously, we've been talking. This is what I found fascinating about this whole experience. It's the first time we've been involved in TVs and video conferencing. We've been involved in meetings and so on. But just the ability for us here locally to informally go offline and talk about the things that we're seeing, the things that are happening, how we as a group here, if we work together pretty closely, could start to use this. As you've said, we've got some ideas already, both for our own communications and also working with kids in a collaborative sort of way, which is something we've had real interest in doing, but it's always seemed too difficult in terms of setting up the technologies and so forth and so on. These tools are pretty simple. Again, I think it's a matter of us saying, what do we need to do? Well, we can use these tools to communicate, obviously. So I think we already have seen the tools that will help us talk. It's then a matter of what are the discussions about. And certainly we'd be interested in being part of discussions with other people.
Gary.
Sorry, John, I was kind of offline multitasking and didn't multitask real well here. What are you asking?
Okay. Well, we were just talking about where do we go from here. In a nutshell, I said that Greg Yellowhead would have to, we'd have to sit here and discuss.
Okay, I'm back on track. I remember hearing that. Just have to pull it out of the audio archives. I think certainly with the discussion has certainly been enlightening and thought-provoking. And, you know, it brings to mind the professional struggle, because we've had these kinds of conversations in the past about what is this future that is forming as a result of the kinds of communications technologies that are starting to emerge and the way people are using them. You know, when we're so used if I think back to some of the early days of introducing tools of technology, we kind of predict how people would use them, and now we don't do that anymore. We just introduce the tool and they will show us
right
how to most effectively use them. You know, so we don't even bother trying to, when we're servicing staff or particularly with students, we don't even try and predict how they're going to use it. Just turn loose. But I guess the professional struggle around that is the whole notion of in loco parentis and the other, it's the two people, the one on the one shoulder that says, let them have at her and figure this thing out and do whatever. And then the one on the other shoulder is saying, hey, wait a minute, we have a responsibility for the safe and protected environment. And so how do you blend that? And that's probably where I'd like to see some of these discussions go in the future. So I think it's becoming more and more prominent internal debate than it has been in years gone by. We've had it in years gone by, but I think it's we're seeing a snowballing of the kinds of communication, like the whole notion of Net 2, that people are creating rather than just consuming. So I think that's on a professional level, that's kind of where, personally, I'd like to see some of the discussion go. And then, hopefully get get some resolution as to just exactly what we do to make sure we're relevant, but also to make sure that we've met that in local branches responsibility.
I'll throw another point out to Gord right now, too, is when we talk about where do we go next, I think we have to recognize what we know about effective TV. And if Gord sends out an agenda and says, why don't you join us, whatever, right? It'll be a Gord-driven or if it's a John-driven kind of direction. It's not going to be nearly as effective as the group of educators that are here on the education side say, I think we need to do something around this together, because effective PD really is individuals getting together, not somebody telling you how to do it, at the end of this. Although, you know, when we talked about the whole authority thing here, I think sometimes we can use the type of model that we're using within the system right now, where we look at the what and why kinds of variables of why K-12 education exists. And a lot of that is driven from society's values, that we're a democratic society. So a lot of that's laid on the table in this employee and employer context. Mm-hmm. On the other side of it is, we really don't mess around in the how. Teachers are hired to determine the how with the administrators within a K-12 system. It even goes into the technology department here. I can ask John to figure out something on a peering proxy and whatever else to set it all up, and I've got a vague understanding of what it is and why we want to do that. But I don't have a clue how he's going to do that. Same thing with Lyle and Lee when they define active directories and those kind of structures. But then that's when the PD kind of comes in again, is when we recognize that it's a new territory. We can put the enablers in, build the professional growth kinds of opportunities, but can you take the horse to the pond and run the horse drink? Right? Those are all of the issues around us. At the end of this, back to your accountability, is how well. And in this context that we're in within Alberta Ed right now, how well is a very critical variable on schools' performances, like it or not. That's our context in the short term, probably for most of us until we retire. But we do have this big variable that you're talking about in the background. What are these kids? You know, they're not the kids from the 50s and the 60s when I went to school, or the 60s and 70s for some, and maybe 80s for some of the others that are out there right now. So that's kind of it. So where do we go next, Gord? I think we need to pop it around a little bit.
Okay, thanks, John. James over here, you want to tell the crew what you whispered in my ear a few minutes ago?
I was just thinking one thing we could do is, in our separate groups, each division, we could kind of try and draft out some kind of guidelines for teachers about, like, good practices or whatever. I don't know, not necessarily policy, but even just like things to think about if you're going to introduce blogging and wikis and that kind of stuff into your classrooms. And because that will probably, just thinking about those guidelines, will probably bring up a lot of the key issues. And it'll be really interesting for Jim Graniella Head to share with Wolf Briefing. But I'm sure there'll be a lot of overlap, but there'll also lots of things that we haven't thought about, and vice versa. Mostly the structures work to do.
First step along the way.
Yeah.
Reaction from Peter and Gary?
What we've been talking about is the idea that we'd have a session, something like this, but where we'd be showing people how to do, say, blogs or whatever, get some people going, and we'll find out, we'll learn what the policies or procedures might be before we even start setting these things.
So I think we're into some wrap-up stuff.
Yes. Okay, at this point, I think... maybe if we can have some final word here from Wolf Creek and from Black Gold, and then I think a few people here have a few things they would like to say as well.
Thanks, Bert. I'll start first. First of all, Stephen, just a thank you on behalf of Wolf Creek for guiding us through some very thought-provoking discussions over the last couple of days, and certainly showing us some very
key and interesting parts of the internet that you've really, I think, enlightened me on probably how my own kids are using the internet. Even though I try to monitor that as much as I could as a parent, I'm certainly convinced I missed a lot of it. I didn't find my daughter anywhere on the Nexopia, though. I'm pretty good there. I know Terry's captured every single link that she took us to, and we'll spend some time looking at them in greater detail. And certainly a broadening of the horizons has certainly occurred here. And you've certainly brought again to the forefront that whole struggle that I mentioned a few minutes ago about how do we build that relevance into what we're doing for our kids, and yet at the same time meet that in loco parentis responsibility, and meet the mandate as Minister of Education in terms of the stuff that John just mentioned. So once again, thank you. I'll turn it over to Peter.
Thanks, Terry. We worked out, Blackwell wasn't originally involved in this, and John and I and some others were in a conference, and John just happened to mention your name, Steve, and that this was happening. And I gave a plague that I didn't say anything, but then John told me later on and said, I saw your eyes light up, and that's Stephen Dawson. And so he invited us, and again, I really appreciate Grandiela doing that. It's been very good. I've been fascinated by a lot of the stuff on your site, Stephen, and always impressed, quite honestly, with every day there's more stuff that's interesting. There's always something interesting there. And again, I think you've gone through a lot of things over the last few days that have sparked the interest of our group here and are motivating us to try a few things differently. And so we certainly appreciate that. And the areas where specifically we're looking at trying to do things differently are the whole idea of collaboration amongst kids. So in effect, creating communities in the way you're expressing it. And it's something we've tried to do a number of times, haven't been really successful, but I think you've given us some insight and some tools here where we're going to give it another shot. I think we're at a stage now where we will be successful. And a lot of that is because that's where our teachers are now. They're at the stage where these tools will work for them too. So we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Both Gary and Peter, and I think what's come out of a lot of the discussion we have it locked away, and we go on with the next. But it's an exploration of issues, and I think that ongoing kind of need for further understanding and whatnot is what's going to drive this this activity, you know, into the future here. And at this point, I'd like to call on...
right here.
Okay. Stuart behind me here. Stephen with a small gift of our appreciation.
Small.
For the
gift.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for
really
coming.
Appreciate this.
Sharing this.
I may have to send it by Greenhound. Thanks. I can tell right away this is good. Thank you, sir.
And if I could call on John as well here.
Sure. So I just have a couple of comments. When we were trading emails back and forth in that lunchtime with Gary and Peter, I said, this really reminds me of 1995, and then John Moritz and I, when we were having lunch, we said, you know, in 1995 we put together a very low-speed network across the system. We went to the internet. We brought in Jim Baylog from Albert Education, and he said, okay, here's the internet. Mm-hmm. And we talked about Finger and Gopher and a whole lot of other things, and we're all like, what is this? And we ran through a lot of staff members through that. You were there on that kind of stuff, and it kind of feels the same thing again. Like the Web 2.0 kind of concept really fits well when I look backwards to that context. So the other things that we're trying here with the video conferencing and the broadband, we are truly pushing out right now for what does this mean to be collaborative beyond a Grand Yellowhead context. And I say that because right now a lot of our professional learning community dialogue is school-centric.
Sure.
And we're trying to get that at least inter-school within a division. But what I'm really enjoying is the opportunity to work with a couple other school jurisdictions now on the pedagogical side of why we're in business, because Peter and Gary and a few others, with the old telephone systems and the email, we've worked for years on technology support as to which directions to go. So we've been pushing the window here a little bit different. But I guess in closing, Stephen, a couple of quick comments. The first would be, you now know where the bunker is at ESC.
Yes, and how to get in.
How to get in through the four doors, and a lot of people over there know that too. And I think they gave you a painting from a local artist, one of our school teachers, very renowned within the area here.
Yeah.
And that might be a more of a long-term kind of memento from Grand Yellowhead, and also reflecting Black Gold and Wolf Creek. But when we first started this thing, Gart said, should we get Stephen something for coming on up? I said, yeah, we always do that kind of a thing. And Gart says, what should we get him? I said, well, if it was me, I'd get him a bottle of scotch. Right? But I said, you better figure out, first off, right, is that if that's an appropriate gift. So we said, well, let's get a hold of Bill Fricker. And then he couldn't get a hold of Bill Fricker. So then Gord talked with him last night. He says, well, based on the conversation with Stephen, that would probably fit. So we get you a second gift right now. And it's a nice bottle of scotch.
Nice.
So when you go back right home, you can sit there and
thank you so much.
Savor the moments. Right?
You wouldn't even get when I get back home.
It's a nice one.
Very nice.
There's that 5-hour wait in the Toronto airport, but this might help.
I'll put this to very good use.
But we do want a little qualitative feedback, because it's not one that I've ever tried.
Oh. I've had fun with it. It's very good.
Yeah,
very
nice. 15.
Yeah, it's I'm pretty well know what to expect from that. I'm looking very much forward to it.
Well, join me in thanking Stephen for that.
Thanks a lot, and before we go, of course, as you know, I've been recording this. There are people who've been, or who will have been, following along with us for hours and hours and hours now, and they will have gotten to know some of you and some of your voices and all of that, and I think it would be nice if those of you who want to, you don't have to, but if you could just say who you are so that people will be able to put a name to the voice they've been listening to for the last 8 to 10 hours or so.
That's okay.
Oh, I'm Jennifer Hardy.
Ernie Lager.
Kurt Scobie.
James Bathroom.
Gordon Booth.
John Percival.
Brian Lee.
Lyle Lee.
John Marcia.
Barb Shepard.
Bell Dick.
Stuart Graham.
Peter.
Peter Goldring.
Bruce McGilbert.
Cindy Mackey. Baker.
Gary.
Terry Maugh.
Wayne Hugel.
Bruce Miller.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And for those of you who don't know online, I'm Stephen Dance, and we're signing off now. Thanks a lot. You guys are really the ones who made this work really well, and I really appreciate it. And when you listen to this online, you'll see how important your contribution was to this, because it wouldn't have been impossible. So I really appreciated being here, and I've learned a lot, and it's been really good for me. So thank you very much.
Thank you.